Chabad Danurg Audio.
This lecture is presented by Rabbi Lezer Gurkov, Rabbi at Congregation Beth Tfilah in London, Ontario.
Tonight's lecture is about Hillel and his primary disciple, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Hillel lived for 120 years. He was born roughly 110 before the Common Era and died at around the turn of the first century, around the year 10 of the first century. And for the last 40 years of his life, which are the primary years in terms of his historical relevance, he was the Nasi, the religious leader of the Jewish people. To understand the definition of this office, we have to return to the time that the Beit HaMikdash was first built and the arrangement of power in the new fledgling society that was created around the Beit HaMikdash in Israel. The leaders of the Bnei Yisrael, of the Jewish community that returned to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash in the year 350 before the Common Era, that's the year the second Beit HaMikdash was completed, were Ezra and his partner Nehemiah. They both returned to Israel from the exile in Babylon. Ezra was the religious leader. He inspired the Jews to return to Torah and to the path of observance. And Nehemiah was the temporal leader appointed by the Persian king to be responsible for issues such as security and tax collection, etc. Generally speaking, the tax collector was de facto the temporal leader of the Jewish people because he represented the power of the king and also, of course, was empowered by the king to collect taxes, and more often than not, tax collectors were permitted to collect more than the amount they were required to send to the king, and therefore were able to collect great amounts of money from the populace to solidify their own position. Not to say that Nehemiah did that, because Nehemiah was a very righteous person. But I bring the example of Ezra and Nehemiah to demonstrate that precedent had already been set that religious leadership and temporal leadership sat in the hands of two different people. When Ezra passed on in the year 313 before the Common Era, his successor, who was Shimon HaTzadik, Shimon the Righteous, succeeded not only Ezra, but also Nehemiah. Shimon held four positions of power. Shimon was a member of the tribe of Levi, and so he was the Kohen Gadol throughout the course of his life for 40-odd years. Throughout the course of his leadership for 40-odd years, Shimon HaTzadik was the leader of the position of the Kohen Gadol. Shimon HaTzadik also held the position of tax collection, so he succeeded Nehemiah in that area. And then Shimon HaTzadik was also the religious leader of the Jewish people, and at that point, religious leadership was defined in two ways. He was the Nasi, the president of the Sanhedrin, the high Jewish court, and effectively the person responsible and charged with the responsibility of ensuring Jewish education, Jewish fidelity to Torah, and Jewish commitment to observance. And he was also the Av Bet Din, the Supreme Justice, who was responsible for jurisprudence in the Sanhedrin, in the High Jewish Court, and effectively in the network of the judicial system that spread out throughout the land. Shimon HaTzadik was a very successful leader and a very righteous person, and successfully held all four positions. When he passed on in the year 273, his successor, his brother Elazar, was not able to succeed Shimon in the area of religious leadership. He lacked Shimon's scholarship, but he was a pious man. And so he became the high priest and also the tax collector. It was Shimon's primary disciple, Antignos from Socho, who became the religious leader. So with Shimon's passing, the division of powers between religious and temporal leadership that was in fact in place between Ezra and Nehemiah returned and was divided between Antignos as the religious leader and Elazar as the temporal leader. The temporal leader, who was also the Kohen Gadol. Elazar was unable to hold on to both offices, And very soon, the secular, temporal leadership, the position of tax collector, was taken by one of Elazar's relatives, an unscrupulous fellow who ingratiated himself with the Persian authorities and, in effect, took away from Elazar the position of tax collection. Elazar remained the high priest. When Antigonus passed on, he was succeeded by two of his students. And this was the first time that the position of religious leadership was divided between two separate people. Antigonus had two students. One of them was Yossi ben Yoezer, and the other was Yosef ben Yochanan. Yossi ben Yoezer and Yossi ben Yochanan inherited the two positions of Nasi, the presidentship of the Jewish people, at least in a religious context, and the position of Av Bet Din, the supreme Jewish justice. Antigonus passed on in the year 231 before the Common Era, and his two students retained the leadership of the religious area for a number of years. Yossi ben Yoezer is described in the Talmud as the last Eshkol. An Eshkol is a cluster of grapes. The Talmud uses that metaphor for a person that has completely mastered all areas of Torah. That is to say, Ish Shakulo Bo, a man that contains everything. There is not an area of Torah or a detail of Torah that is closed to this incredible mind. We will discuss Hillel and his disciple Rabbi Yochanan, and after that, in next lectures, we'll talk about names such as Rabban Gamliel, Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yehoshua, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, and we'll find that their grasp of Torah was vast. Nevertheless, the Talmud says they did not compare to Yossi ben Yoezer, who was the last Eshkol. Yossi ben Yoezer and Yossi ben Yochanan were succeeded by Shimon ben Shetach, were succeeded by Yehoshua ben Prachya and Nitai Ho'arbeli. Again, Yehoshua ben Prachya was the Nasi, Nitai Ho'arbeli the Av Bet Din, the Chief Justice. In the next generation, Yehoshua ben Prachya and Nitai Ho'arbeli were succeeded by Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shatach. To give you a rough idea, the second generation of what we call Zugot, peers or couples of leadership, partners of leadership, Yehoshua ben Prachya and Nitai Ho'arbeli, they were alive during the revolt of the Hashmonaim, and they lived to see the miracle of Hanukkah. Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shatach, unfortunately, lived to see the dissolution of the house of the Hashmonaim. It was during their time that Yanai, or as he's known by a secular Greek name, Jason, took over the Hashmonai leadership, and himself went over to the side of the Sadducees, the Tzedukim, and upon his passing, his two sons, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, engaged in a civil war and invited Pompey, the Roman general in Syria, to resolve their conflict, and ultimately Hyrcanus was established as king in Israel under the aegis of Rome, which brought Rome into Israel for the very first time. This civil war occurred after the passing of Shimon ben Shatach, and it was during that time that the students of Shimon ben Shatach and Yehuda ben Tabai became the leaders of the Jewish people, succeeded their masters as Nasi and Av Bet Din, and they were Shmaya and Avtalion. Generally speaking, throughout the six generations that the Jewish people were led by what we call the partners, these partners were each the students that sat at the feet of their masters, the former leaders of the Jewish people. Shmaya and Avtalion lived during that awful period of the civil war where thousands of Jews were killed, where battles took place right on the Temple Mount, and generally Shmaya and Avtalion stepped away from involvement in governmental affairs, unlike their predecessor, Shimon ben Shatach, who was related to the king, to Yanai, and often involved himself in advising Yanai on how to conduct himself in accordance with the laws of Torah. Shmaya and Avtalion stepped away from the area of secular leadership and focused exclusively on the area of religious leadership. In fact, it was Shmaya who suggested that one have very little to do with authorities and with governments. In fact, he suggests the Sina et Rabbanut. You should detest the opportunity to attain a position of authority. You should be devoted simply and wholeheartedly to Torah study and to the observance of mitzvot. Shmaya and Naftalion were succeeded by their faithful students Hillel and Shammai. The Mishnah actually teaches there was a rabbi by the name of Menachem that succeeded Avtalion as the Av Bet Din before Shammai became the Av Bet Din. Menachem suffered an ignominious end. It's unclear whether he became a heretic or whether he was taken captive by Babylon and forced into slave labor. Either way, Shammai succeeded as the Av Bet Din. Our area of discussion today focuses really on Hillel. Hillel succeeded Shmaya as the Nasi. We mentioned before the area of responsibility for the president was to ensure Jewish education, to ensure Jewish observance, fidelity to Torah and mitzvah, and to provide as many opportunities as possible to assist Jewish communities in Israel and throughout the world. There were many satellite communities at this point outside of Israel, with their religious development. Hillel hailed from Babel himself, just like Ezra before him. Hillel was born in Babel and came to Israel to study at the feet of Shmaya and of Talion. Hillel was from the family of Benjamin, although through his mother he was a scion of the house of David. Now, he could not have been considered a member of the house of David since tribal rights pass patrilineally through the father. He was only a successor of David or a descendant of David through his mother. But nevertheless, being from the family of David, even matrilineally, conferred a certain degree of royalty or status that came in very handy when he ascended to the leadership of the position of Nasi. When he was a student, he was a very poor person, and unlike some other rabbis of the Talmud who were poor in their youth, Hillel never did attain any level of wealth or prosperity, even when he gained a position of power amongst the Jewish people. He was a very, very poor individual, so much so that during the period of his apprenticeship or his studies, the Talmud testifies that he would make merely one trepik, which Rashi explains was a half golden zuz per day. Half of that trepik went to his family's expenses, and the other half went to the yeshiva. At that time, they charged a half trepik just for admission into the yeshiva so that you can hear the lecture or the sermon. And so he would give away half of his wages, half of his daily wages, for the purpose of studying Torah. Now, of course, there were others who paid that fee, but not many others who were as poor as Hillel was. Hillel had a wealthy brother whose name was Shebna, but Shebna did not support his brother Hillel. And the Talmud mentions that later in life, Shebna asked Hillel if they would be willing to form a partnership where he would provide monetary assistance and Hillel would provide him with some of his merit of Torah studies. And Hillel at that point demurred and said, "It's too late. Now that I am a Nasi, I am a leader, I no longer need your financial assistance. It's not possible for me to share the merit of Torah scholarship with you." This wasn't an issue of revenge. It was simply a matter that if a wealthy person wants to share in the merit of a poor scholar's Torah studies, he needs to provide for that scholar when the scholar is actually in need. By the time Shebna made the offer, Hillel, though not wealthy by any means, was no longer in full need. Well, the Talmud tells us a story that one day Hillel came to the academy on a Friday afternoon, just before Shabbos, and he had no money. And while everyone else in line was able to pay the admission fee, Hillel was unable to pay and was not permitted to enter. Desperate to hear the sermon, Hillel climbed up to the roof and lay down on the skylight, where he put his ear to the glass and was able to listen and absorb the entire sermon. So absorbed was he with his Torah studies that he didn't notice that the wind began to blow and the snow began to fall. It was during the Hebrew month of Tevet, in the dead of the winter. Throughout the course of the night, three amos, that is roughly 4.5 feet of snow fell upon Hillel. Deprived of oxygen, Hillel fainted and was unable to extricate himself from the snow. In the morning, after a full night of study, Shemaiah turned to his brother Aftalion. Shemaiah and Aftalion were brothers. They were both descendant of converts. And Shemaiah said to Aftalion, "Ordinarily at this time, the light filters through the snow, but now we have no light. What's blocking our light?" And they looked up to the little skylight, and they noticed the silhouette of a person lying under the snow. It was Shabbos morning, but of course they disregarded the Shabbos strictures because a life was at stake. And according to the halacha, a life at stake overrules the strictures of Shabbos. So they immediately went up and they uncovered Hillel, they brought him down, and they dried him, they gave him warm clothing, put him by the fire, rubbed his skin, and revived him. They mentioned at that time that a person who is prepared to literally give his life for Torah is one who deserves that we desecrate Shabbos on his behalf. Well, the Talmud comments that Hillel incriminates the poor because of the fact that he was prepared to go the distance for the purpose of Torah study. Hillel was a brilliant scholar. The Mishnah testifies all the various areas of Torah that Hillel had mastered, and literally there was not an area of Torah that he hadn't exposed himself to. He was a peaceful soul, as we will learn about in a few moments. He was an absolute lover of Torah, as we will see. He believed not only in studying Torah, but also in serving the scholars of Torah. He was a generous benefactor. He had a heart that bled for every person in need and did all he could to help them. He was a humble conciliator. He was always prepared to help resolve conflicts rather than be a part of them. He was a populist leader. He looked out for the needs of the population. He was not an elitist, and he didn't look down upon others. He was a fearless innovator. When innovation was called for, Hillel was not afraid to stand up and stand up for change. And, as we mentioned, he was a penniless pauper and never did become a wealthy man. How did Hillel go from such a poor state as a student to becoming the leader, the Nasi, the president of the Jewish people? Our sages tell us that after completing his course of studies, Hillel returned to Babylon. And while in Babylon, Shemaiah and Aftalion passed away, and Hillel returned to Israel. Whether he arrived to Israel before the funeral, before their passing and attended their funeral, or arrived after their passing and missed their funeral is unclear. But it seems from the following story that Hillel arrived after Shemaiah and Aftalion passed away. And after the passing of Shemaiah and Aftalion, there was no clear successor. The community could not identify clearly which of the disciples would be the proper leader. And in the vacuum, the family of Beterah stepped in. The B'nai Beterah, the sons of Beterah, were an illustrious family who produced great scholars over the course of many generations. And during this period of time, the B'nai Beterah were the best possible choice for the position, and so they stepped in as the Nisi'im, as the joint leaders of the Jewish community. That year, Erev Pesach, the day before Pesach, fell on a Shabbos. And because the Bet HaMikdash, the temple, was still standing, the imperative of bringing the Paschal Lamb was in question. The question was, do we bring the Paschal Lamb on Shabbos, or do we not? The Paschal Lamb can only be brought on the day before Pesach. What happens when that day falls on a Shabbos? Now, halakha, Jewish law, was not documented. It was not transcribed. No one could go to the appropriate book and turn to the right page and determine the halakha as we would today. No, in that time, everyone had to remember what had happened the last time and what the tradition was. And the B'nai B'Terah simply could not recall what the custom was the last time that Erev Pesach fell on Shabbos. It must have been many years since that had last happened. The fact that they could not remember demonstrates in and of itself that they were probably sufficient in scholarship to fill the position of leadership, but certainly not the best qualified for the position. At that time, it was brought to their attention that Hillel the Babylonian was in Jerusalem, and that he served Shemaiah and Aftalion, and he would very likely know the answer. Hillel was brought before the Bateira brothers, and he said that it was permissible and in fact obligatory to bring the Paschal Lamb on that day. When they challenged him to show his proofs, he demonstrated with 7 different arguments, utilizing 7 of the 13 principles of hermeneutics, of exegesis, that are later documented in the name of Rabbi Yishmael. Hillel was the first person who is documented as having used these principles, though surely that he was not the first to use these principles. We understand that these principles were in place ever since God gave the Torah to Moshe and were vigorously applied by Sanhedrins and scholars of all generations. It's just that Hillel is the first to be documented as having used these specific 7 principles or tools of hermeneutics. But each of the arguments were refuted by the Bateira brothers. Finally, Hillel stood up and said, "This is the tradition as I have heard it from Shemaiah and Avtalion, our masters." And when he said that, the B'nai Bateira accepted it. They not only accepted it, but in their extreme humility, they abdicated the position of presidentship, of presidency, and handed the reins of leadership to Hillel. And Hillel, the great scholar of Torah, ascended to the throne of the Jewish leadership. He became the Nasi, the religious leader, the religious president. At that point, he began to rebuke the people around him and to say to them the reason they didn't recall the halacha was simply because they were concerned mostly with studying from Shemaiah and Avtalion, their former masters, but not with serving them. When you serve your master, you become fully subservient to your master, and the Torah filters through and permeates every pore of your body, and it dominates your memory bank, and you cannot forget. Well, the Talmud teaches this as a very example of why a person should never rebuke another in a sense of speaking down to him, should never become haughty in the course of rebuking another. And this was Hillel's one occasion where he let go, at least slightly, of his humility. And because of that, the Talmud teaches that he forgot another halacha to show him that one must retain moral superiority at all times in order to retain scholarly superiority. A question was asked of Hillel at that point, which he could not remember the halacha to, and he then said, "If I cannot recall the halacha, leave it to the practice of the population. B'nai Yisrael," he said, "Hanachli B'nai Yisrael, leave the children of Israel alone. Imeinam Nevim, if they are not prophets, B'nai Nevim Haim, they are the children of prophets. And just watch their practice and you will see that it will conform to the actual halacha." The next day, when he saw the practice of the population, of the people, with regards to this specific halacha, he then remembered that that was, in fact, the halacha as his teachers had taught. Hillel learned his lesson very well, and never again did he allow his own experience, his own expertise, his superiority, to stand in the way of his humility. So, in order to ascend to the position of Nasi, he first debated the people of Bateira, and after his debate, he was able to claim that this was his tradition from the house of Shammai, and then later he rebuked them, and as a result, he forgot some of his studies and ultimately learned his lesson. The Talmud speaks of 3 innovations. There were probably more, but 3 of them that we mentioned tonight and that were clearly recorded in the Talmud that were, in a sense, new and original and required a certain level of courage of Hillel, and due to his prestige, he was able to carry them through. All of them were Mipnei Tikkun Olam, because the average populace had a need, and Hillel came to fill that need. Hillel was a leader of the people. Hillel cared for the needs. He wasn't living in the ivy tower, oblivious to the needs of the average person in the marketplace. One of them is called the Peruzbul, and it relates to the halacha of Shemitah. Every 7th year is a Shemitah, it's a sabbatical year, and in addition to leaving the fields lie fallow, there is also a Torah law that all debts are annulled on the year of Shemitah. That meant that many lenders refused to lend money in the months preceding the year of Shemitah. Now, the Torah specifically prohibits a reluctance to lend money in advance of Shemitah because of a fear of the debt being annulled. And people, nonetheless, were unable to overcome their reluctance and their concerns that they would lose their money when the Shemitah, when the sabbatical would annul the outstanding debts. And so they refused to lend money in the months or the years preceding the Shemitah. Hillel devised a technical solution to the problem, noting that the debt, only private debts are annulled, but public debts are not annulled. That is to say, public money that is forwarded in a context of a loan by the Bet Din, representative of the entire Jewish community, are not annulled by the approach or the onset of the Shemitah sabbatical. Hillel therefore suggested that lenders can transfer their money to the public coffers under the authority or under the supervision of the Bet Din of the Jewish court, and then the Jewish court can distribute the money as loans, allocate the loans to the people in need, and ultimately collect them as well, even if the Shemitah comes in. This was a clear innovation. No one had ever tried that before. It was a loophole, a way of circumventing a specific mitzvah of the Torah. But because of Hillel's prestige, he was able to carry it through. Because of his concern for the average needs of the people on the street, he was moved to carry it through. Another example of Hillel's enactments on behalf of the average person revolves around a halacha in the Torah that if a Jew sells a house that is built in a city that was walled in during the time that the Jewish people first conquered the land of Israel, the house can be repurchased by the buyer as long as he repurchases it within the course of the first 12 months. And the buyer cannot refuse the seller's offer to repurchase the house. Many buyers would buy homes in these cities, and then in the days preceding the deadline, they would go and hide to make sure that the seller would not be able to repurchase the home. Hillel developed a solution and offered for all sellers of homes in such cities to rebuy their home through the aegis of the Bet Din, the Jewish court, utilizing a halacha called Hefker Bez Din Hefker, that Bet Din, the Jewish court, has the power to extract holdings from the possession of a private owner and make them available to the public. Hillel therefore taught that a seller who wants to repurchase his home during the course of the first 12 months but cannot find the buyer may deliver the money to the court. The court will then exercise eminent domain rights and will extract the house from the possession of the buyer, award it to the original seller, and hold on to the money until such time as the buyer would choose to come and collect his money. Once again, a fearless innovation, but one he was moved to make because of his concern for the actual people out in the marketplace. A third innovation concerned the people of Alexandria, who were in a very difficult religious plight. What was their difficulty? During that time, there were some thugs in Alexandria that made it a habit to kidnap brides right before they entered their chuppah on their wedding night and have their way with the brides and then release them back to their husbands. It was a way of debasing the Jewish community, humiliating them, and of course causing them to suffer. But the fallout, the religious fallout, was extreme, because the first child that these brides would bear to their husbands was possibly a product of their union, their illicit union, with their captors on the night of their wedding. And that being the case, the child was possibly a mamzer, a bastard according to Torah law, which would prohibit the child from marrying another Jew. A mamzer may only marry a fellow mamzeret, and this was a very grave difficulty. The difficulty rested on the premise that the kidnapping would occur after the ketubah was signed, effectively deeming the husband and wife married, and therefore the illicit rape, for lack of a better word, an adulterous relationship, and the product of such an adulterous relationship would be a bastard, a mamzer by Torah law. Hillel asked to see the ketubah before he would rule on the question, and noting that the text of the ketubah read that the marriage would be consummated upon entrance under the chuppah, Hillel deemed the illicit union between the brides and their captors a relationship that was not adulterous, because the brides were technically or legally not yet married to their husband. So even if the child were a product of the thug's intimacy with his mother, it would not affect his status as a Jew, because Judaism is conferred by the mother, not by the father. Nor would it affect his status as a mamzer or as a kosher Jew, because the mother was not married at that time. It might certainly affect the question of tribal rights, but not knowing for certain whether the child was the son of the father or the son of the thug who had raped the mother, the child was awarded tribal rights through his father. Nevertheless, most tribal rights concerned themselves with real estate in Israel, and these people lived in Alexandria, which was a city in Egypt, and so it didn't have any specific relevance to them in any case. It was only important from the point of view of genealogy. So these were three innovations that are attributed to Hillel. Hillel had an incredible ethic of Torah study. Hillel said it's not only important to study Torah, as we mentioned before, it's important to serve Torah masters, Torah scholars. He demonstrated that one who studies Torah without being in close relationship, without studying from a teacher, will often err and go off in a wrong direction. There are several stories in the Talmud through which Hillel demonstrated that supposedly great scholars of Torah were in complete error about several very obvious issues because they were not in the habit of consulting masters of Torah that were greater than themselves. We mentioned before that Hillel's ethic of Torah study compelled him to study every area of Torah, and there was literally not a facet of Torah that was not open to this man. Hillel was a man of peace. As the Talmud calls him, an anvantan, a humble person. The Talmud tells three stories of proselytes that approached Hillel. They approached Shammai first and then Hillel. The stories are relatively well known. They can be found in the Tractate of Shabbat, page 31, folio A. One proselyte approached Shammai and said, "I would like to study only the written Torah. I would not like to study the oral Torah." Shammai rejected this applicant for conversion out of hand, and the applicant went to Hillel. Hillel said to him, "I'd be happy to study with you. Come, let's sit down and learn the alphabet." Hillel showed him, "This is an aleph, this is a bet, this is a gimel, this is a dalet," and then told him to go home, review his lesson, and come back the next day. The next day, Hillel reviewed the lesson with him and said, "This is a dalet, this is a gimel, this is a bet, this is an aleph." Well, the applicant, the proselyte, said to him, "Hillel, my master, yesterday you taught me in the reverse." Hillel smiled and said, "My son, if you need to rely upon my integrity as a scholar simply to learn the language of the Torah, then you may as well rely upon me for transmitting the tradition of the oral Torah." The proselyte was taken by Hillel's approach and in fact accepted and became a fully observing member of the Jewish people and converted, embracing the Jewish faith. Another proselyte approached Shammai and said, "I would like to study the Torah. Teach it to me as you're standing on one foot." Shammai thought he was mocking him, and he rejected him. The man went to Hillel, and Hillel said to him, as he was standing on one foot, "What you don't like done unto you, don't do unto others. This is the entire Torah. The rest is just commentary. Go and study." These words, of course, echo through the generations. We hear them in so many different ways, places, and times. This man too was taken by Hillel, and he too converted. The third story is about a person, a non-Jew, who passed by a Torah school for little children, and he heard the teacher describe the royal garments that the high priest wore. He walked into the school and asked the teacher, he said, "Who wears such royal garments?" And the teacher said, "The high priest does." Well, the man went to Shammai and said, "I'd like to convert and become a high priest." Shammai rejected him. Hillel accepted him, and he said to him, "My son, if you'd like to be a high priest, you need to learn the tactics, the rituals. Come, sit down, we'll learn." They started studying, and they reach the first parsha, the first section in the book of Bamidbar, the book of Numbers, and they read, "V'hazar hakarev yumat," a foreigner that approaches the sanctuary will be put to death. And so the man asked Hillel, "Who are these foreigners that the Torah speaks of?" Hillel says, "Anyone who doesn't belong to the tribe of Levi, even David, the king of Israel." The proselyte then said, "If the Jewish people, whom God loves, refers to them not only as his child but as his firstborn, may not approach the sanctuary, how much more so a non-Jew who converts into Judaism?" So taken was he by the sanctity and the purity of Judaism that he too converted. He had two children. He named them after Hillel's children. He named one Shimon, the other Gamliel, and henceforth these children were known as Hillel's converts. One day these three converts got together and they said, "Shammai's demanding exactitudes would have driven us from under the wings of God's presence. It was Hillel's humility and peaceful ways, his welcoming attitude, that gathered us in under the wings of God's presence, of the Shekhinah." Now, in defense of Shammai, it must be noted that during this time, the burgeoning of the Jewish Christian movement began, and there were many people who applied for conversion that were suspect in the eyes of the rabbis because they perhaps wanted to become a part of the Jewish people only for the purpose of proselytizing their own idolatrous and pagan faiths. So Shammai was suspect of any applicant that didn't seem sincere. It was Hillel's humble and welcoming attitude that allowed him to read the character of the people that applied and to discern who was sincere and sift them from the insincere. The Talmud tells of a wager that two people made to see whether they can anger or rile Hillel. The Talmud tells us that Hillel on a Friday afternoon was bathing, and a man walked up into a street and started calling, "Hillel, Hillel! Not my master, not where is the president, just Hillel, come on out, I have a question." Hillel dried off and robed himself and came out, and he said, "Ask my son, what do you want to ask?" And he asked an insignificant question. The man asked him, "Why is it that Babylonians have flat heads? They're not round, they're not cone-shaped like ours, or oval-shaped." And so Hillel said, "My son, you asked a very important question. It's because their midwives are not expert, so the heads are deformed as they are born, as they come through the birth canal." So Hillel walked back in, disrobed, went back into his bath, and the man called out, "Hillel, Hillel, I have another question." Hillel gets out, dries off, dresses up, comes out. The man says, "Why is it that the Tarmidaim have round, small slits for eyes?" Hillel said, "A very important question you asked. The reason is because they live in an area that have many sandstorms, and God provided for them, or maybe they adapted through nature, so that their eyes would not constantly be besieged by particles of sand." Hillel went back into his home, disrobed, started bathing, and the man said, "Hillel, Hillel, I have another question." Hillel walks out, dries up, dresses up, comes out. "What would you like?" He says, "Why is it that the Afrikaim have wide feet?" Hillel says, "A very important question, my son. It's because they live in an area filled with springs and water banks, and so they don't wear their shoes, and their feet are therefore never molded or formed. They're not shaped by the mold of their shoes." So the man said, "Hillel, I've got many questions. Surely you'll be upset with me. You're impatient with me." Hillel says, "No, sit down. I have all the time in the world." So the man said, "Are you the man they call Hillel, the leader of Israel?" Hillel says, "That is I." The man said, "Lo yirbu kimotcha b'Yisrael, may there not be many Hillels in the community of Israel." Hillel said, "Why is that, my son?" He said, "Because of you, I lost 400 zuz," and he told him about the wager. Hillel said to him, "Bini, my son, he's a her beruchacha. Be very careful in engaging your own moods and your own spirit. Keep a tight lid on your own temper. You should be forced to pay 400 zuz and another 400 zuz. But Hillel will not be a kapdan. Hillel will never be impatient. Hillel will not lose his temper." The Talmud tells us of Hillel's incredible compassion and charitable ways. Even when he became a leader, he never forgot his humble origins. So the Talmud teaches us that Hillel developed a standard that if a person applies to the public fund for charity, he needs to be provided for not only for his needs, but also for the standards to which he has become accustomed. So if he was formerly a wealthy man, he needs to be provided for at that level of wealth. Now, the Talmud tells us that a man that had been formerly wealthy applied to Hillel for charitable assistance. Hillel asked him what his standards were, and he said, "I'm accustomed to having a horse to ride on and a servant to clear the way before me." And Hillel assigned him a horse and a servant from the charitable funds. One day the servant couldn't arrive in time, and so Hillel, the leader of Israel, ran in front of the horse to clear the way for this fellow who had become poor and was formerly wealthy. That's how concerned Hillel was, not only with the needs of a Jewish person, but also with their dignity. Hillel taught, you must always love peace and pursue peace. The pursuit of peace is only necessary when it doesn't easily come to you, when it's a challenge, when you feel riled by someone's words or actions. Hillel said, pursue peace. You might be the Nasi, the leader of Israel. If there's a person in your presence who is in need, you need to help him out and pursue that avenue, even if it's not for your own even if it's not to your own dignity. Hillel taught, never judge another person until you reach his place. That gives rise to the aphorism, don't judge another man until you've walked in his shoes. I once saw a humorous explanation. Don't judge another person until you've walked at least a mile in his shoes. Number one, by now you're a mile away, so he can't do anything to you if you judge him. Number two, what's he going to do? You're wearing his shoes. How can he chase you? Back to Hillel. Physical and spiritual hygiene were very important to Hillel. Every day Hillel would go home from the academy, his students would accompany him and say, Hillel, where are you going? And he would say, I'm going to look after my guest. I'm going to bathe my guest. They asked him every day, you have a guest? And Hillel said, yes, of course I do. Don't you realize that our lives, our very souls are guests in this world? We won't live forever. And so we are required to treat our souls with the same dignity and the same care and concern that we would treat our guests. And when he spoke of the soul in the physical sense, that meant his living body. So he bathed every day. He explained that this was a method of serving God because man was created in the image of God. And if, as Hillel said, if there was a wax museum and there were wax models of the king, of the emperor, would the staff responsible for the museum not be required to lovingly clean and wash and bathe the model or the bust of the king so that it appears dignified and royal? Would they be permitted to allow the model or the bust of the king to become dusted and ruined and fall into a state of disrepair? Surely we who walk as the image of the King of Kings should be careful not only with our hygiene to ensure that we are externally fresh and clean and well bathed and scrubbed, but also with our physical health so that we don't fall in, God forbid, to a state of disrepair. Hillel established the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai, the school of Hillel and the school of Shammai. Hillel and Shammai themselves had only three areas in which they disputed each other. Their students who studied from them disputed more than 300 points of Jewish law. Hillel in general, as we were able to see, was a welcoming and peaceful and engaging person. Shammai was an exacting and demanding person. He demanded even of himself, and that's why he demanded of others. The Talmud tells us that when Shammai came across a delicacy or a nice garment, he wouldn't allow himself to partake of the delicacy as soon as he saw it. He would force himself to hold off, to rein in his temptations and discipline himself so that he would hold off until the next Shabbos and use the delicacy to honor the Shabbos. So that's the kind of expectation he had of himself, and that's what he demanded of others. And true to form, in areas of halakha, Shammai favored a more stringent view, a more prohibitive view. And Hillel favored a more welcoming attitude, a more lenient attitude, a more permissible attitude. That is not to say that he was lenient and just and accepting of people that were in violation of the laws of the Torah. But it just simply means that when it comes to building the fence around the Torah and adding rabbinical restrictions to the actual biblical prohibitions, Hillel was in favor of loosening the additional restrictions, while Shammai was in favor of more severe restrictions. So accordingly, there's the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai, their students, usually disputed the points of halacha in accordance with the nature and the personalities of their teacher. The house of Hillel was more often lenient, the house of Shammai was more often stringent. Nevertheless, despite their differences, they had a great deal of love and affection for each other. They would do things together, they would visit people together, and they would even marry into each other's families. Why is it that the house of Hillel ultimately ruled and gained the upper hand in terms of halacha? Well, we'll come back to that in a moment, but for now I wanted to point out how severe the difference between the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai became. With more than 300 points of differences between them, the students of each of the academies became fully entrenched to the extent that each fully believed that their way was right and the other was wrong. It was the Torah, as the Talmud says, was in danger of splitting and becoming two different Torahs. The reason this occurred was because in all previous generations, whenever a dispute arose, the matter was brought to the Sanhedrin, the high Jewish court, who deliberated, they analyzed, they debated, and they took a vote, and the majority vote held the day. The halakha followed the majority rule. But in Hillel and Shammai's day, the political and military situation of the Jewish people in Israel was so precarious that it was impossible for the Sanhedrin to convene and to deliberate with the peace and the calm that is necessary to explore and to debate and to analyze the complex issues at hand. So the Sanhedrin never did have an opportunity to resolve these areas of dispute. And without resolving, the disputes simply grew. One spawned another. And it was not until after the temple was destroyed, and as we will see soon, that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai established an academy in Yavne, that the opportunity arose to begin resolving these disputes. When they resolved the disputes, finally, most of the disputes were resolved in favor of the house of Hillel, the more lenient and permissive and welcoming manner. Why is that? The Talmud testifies this is not because Hillel was more correct than Shammai. In fact, the Talmud says a voice came from heaven and declared that they're both correct, that they both reflect the words of the living God. Only the words of Hillel carried the day because the students of Hillel were like their master. They were humble and peace-loving. They were soft-mannered, mild-mannered. They always remembered to point out that the house of Shammai disagreed with them. In fact, they always brought the opinion of Shammai before they cited their own opinion. It was because of their humility that the halakha followed their position.